Session number 9797.
Beeman Real Tour.
Yes, so Dixie Dean and I were posted together to this Chendera Dam, which is on a lake to the north of Malaya. Now, at this time, the Chinese bandits were in the area, and they were becoming more bold as they got away with things, so they increased their activity. And one of their main activities at this time was ambushing. Now, Malaya, on the main road in Malaya, on the main road, any road in Malaya, ideal place for ambush, they're very twisty, uphill and downhill to the mountain ranges. And on a bend, on any bend, you can lob a tree down across the road, you don't see it until you're actually on the bend. You either crash into the thing or stop, and once you stop or once you crash into it, then your ambush opens up with dozens of rifle fire and you just can't survive. It was a terrible place of ambushes, and this developed to lays down to the High Commissioner of Malaya died in an ambush and it got so bad. But going to Grieg, north of Kuala Kangsar, it was a very, very twisty road indeed. So it was always a breathtaking journey, because around every bend there could have been a fallen tree and death waited you, because if you got caught in an ambush, you had very little chance, if you were in one or two cars, to get out of it. Once you run into this tree around the bend, you couldn't see the in front, you couldn't stop or take any evasive action until you actually saw the tree, and by this time you were in the killing zone. So it was always a breathtaking experience to drive up to Chendera Dam. Anyway, we got to Chendera Dam, and we had a squad of people with us, and our job was to really patrol around to make sure nothing happened to the dam. Impossible situation, because if the wall went on for 10 years, how could it be defended for 10 years? It couldn't be. But anyway, we made a camp in the dam, and from there we started patrolling by map around the area to see if there were any camps, any Chinese, and there were. We came across various Chinese camps, uninhabited at the time, but ready for them should they want to get away from the inhabited areas. We had one or two skirmishes. We saw, funny enough, you can usually recognise a bandit in the jungle, in the deeper jungle like that. You don't normally get the ordinary Chinese villager or Chinese shopkeeper in his normal dress going into the jungle like that. They usually got some sort of uniform on, and they all have a red star on their hat, a yellow type khaki like hat. Motley sort of people, but if you see one you recognise them, because the jungle, if you see anything, it's so fleeting they're gone before you have a chance. Very, very difficult, different type of warfare complete of the other. So we did see the occasional Chinese like that. We shot two of them. We didn't know who they were, and we were, I've no idea how long we were there. We were there for quite a while, and Dixie was a very nice chap. He'd start 7 o'clock every morning. We always had beer there, and he started drinking. He was a terrible man for drinking, and he used to sing all day long if we were around, you know, not on patrol of the jungle, where they used to sing. And he felt sorry for me, because I'm completely tone deaf, I can't sing. He said, "Jim, while we're up here, I'll teach you to sing." He did everything to teach me to sing. And, you know, I had not a nice experience with Dixie. Anyway, that was Chendera Dam. That was our first posting. I mean, it couldn't go on. We were defending this against the Chinese, but I don't think they had the ability, the know-how, or the intention to blow up the dam, because it survived the war, as far as I know. It survived the emergency. After 10 years, I'm sure that Chendera Dam was never attacked. It was just a thought, or maybe the powers to be had information. That's why they sent us up there. Anyway,
what year was this, and what time?
This was 1948. And the emergency started in June, and I was out there by September.
So this is towards the end of 48?
That's right. Yes, it was towards the end of 48, when everything was beginning to happen, because the emergency now was just taking on the powers to be, had to do all sorts of things. But if I can just, before we go on to that, just describe a little bit of how I became familiar with the jungle. As I say, Kuala Kangsar lies astride the River Pier, which is a very wide river, which winds up and down the country. Oh, I just come back. Up and down the country, and it's a beautiful thing. But the jungle is very menacing around there, because all through the emergency, when the Japanese, all through the war, when the Japanese were there, all these 20,000 Chinese communists had made themselves quite comfortable. They were four years they were there, so they made the most enormous camps. And in these camps, they had made themselves netball pitches. You could see, you saw them, I've got photographs of them. They made themselves sort of swimming pools. They were always normally astride or near a river, Of course, there were a lot of rivers coming down from the mountains, but they had the essential thing, water. And always near water, these camps. And they were hundreds of yards long. They had parade grounds, they had drill grounds, they had everything. All sorts of offices, let's say sports fields and everything. They were really big. And if my sort of patrol with 30 men or less ever ran into one of these camps when it was occupied, we would be absolutely slaughtered, you know. You don't get slaughtered like that, because once the shooting starts, you disappear. But this was it. We patrolled the jungle, and I was learning about the jungle from these Malays and from these Indians. I said, right, today we'd go out, and maybe go out for 3 or 4 days at a time. Sometimes we go on short trips. It was guided by the activity of bandits. They were getting there where they were ambushing, like you're hearing in now with the Tamils, they were ambushing civilian buses and killing certain people in them, you know. They were attacking isolated estate managers. So our job was, if there was any information of bandits being in a certain area, we'd go out there, maybe to rubber plantation, and see the manager there and see what the trouble was. And he would say, right, some bandits came down to some of my workers and demanded through from them. Of course, we all know eventually we found out that they were actually living. They got all their food from all the Chinese and all the Tamil rubber tappers, not voluntarily. I can't explain to you, a rubber estate is miles and miles from anywhere, vast areas with all rows and rows of rubber trees, and Tamils normally employed every day to go up and down these roads, cutting a slice out of the tree, and all the latex runs down. It's their job to do it, and they're happy doing it. It's a living they know, you know. And then all this latex is collected in buckets and then made into the process in the factory in a certain place. But they had to go out in these rubber estates, miles from anywhere, just a handful of them, early in the morning, collecting all this rubber out of the cup, which had caught it, and cutting a new slice so it dripped till the next day, and then coming out again. Chinese bandits come out, there's nobody in the area. They come up and say, look, tomorrow we want you to bring us some rice, or we want you to do this, or want you to do that. There's no way could they say no. This man was an armed man. They knew he was a bandit, a Chinese bandit. It would mean they couldn't work anymore if they didn't do it. They had to do it. So this is how the Chinese survived, by threats and coercion with these people tapping rubber. That was one source. And then they go into villages where the shopkeeper, and they go in, because you couldn't tell a bandit from another if they're dressed the same. You couldn't say the shopkeeper you were drinking from could be a bandit for all you know. They'd come out and they say, look, we want so many thousands of pounds from you this week or every month or whatever. The bloke may have been a communist and willingly give it to him. He might not be a communist and not want to give it to him. He might give it to him, then report it to the police. You know, you get information. In fact, I'd like to say now that the end of the emergency 10 years later really was a cause of information. The Chinese, they're very subversive. They love secret societies. They love gambling and this sort of thing. And then they also, if you pay them a lot of money, just as quickly go the other way. They'll come out and they give you all the information about all their friends who they were living with all those years, and get them all killed just to get the money. They were secret societies. In their nature to be subversive. You can get them and bribe them and get them on your side. That's how the War of Malaya really came to an end. The police department, the CID, they established this line of communication with certain people, and this really did a lot at the end of the emergency to bring it to a conclusion. So you could never tell. So we would get information of Chinese being a certain area, and we'd go up to a rubber plantation where they reported. We'd go to with a Tamil to where he was tapping these trees, and he'd show us where they were, and we'd try to look for paths and tracks, and then we'd follow these tracks, and often we'd catch up with them and kill a few. If I just say here that these bandits had been all through the 4-year war with Japan in the jungle. They were very jungle expert. Nobody could touch them, and they were really good soldiers at this time, because their communication was no problem. They knew the jungle backwards, you know, and they knew how to survive in the jungle. And they had their lines of supply set up. They had their jungle farms, and they had all their lines of communication where they get the money and everything from. They were in a very good position. But the one thing, when they were in a camp, they established a system that when they were in a camp, either 20 of them, 30 of them, or 100 of them, the one thing they insisted on, there were always, if there was a camp, there had to be a track, you know, for 20 or 30 people, there had to be a track somewhere. So on every track, they had either one sentry or two sentries, one near the camp and one outlying. And to the point of death, they would be shot if they disobeyed this. Their one reason for being on the sentry post was to fire a shot if anybody came. And if they didn't do that, they would get bloody shot by the Chinese themselves, because that's the only way they could survive. They'd have a camp, and the track had to run through it, because they'd make a track going in and out of it. So a track came. On every track, there was one sentry or two sentries, one half a mile away and one on the camp. So whoever came along this track, all his one object in life was to fire a shot and run, disappear in the jungle. That was all he was asked to do. And if he didn't do it, he'd be killed by his own people. So if you wanted to, if you could locate a camp and came into it, not on a track, you might infiltrate into a camp, as I will tell you we did later on, you know. But one of my first experiences at this time, after Grieg, was that I was telling you how they got information. You go to the Tamil who had his rubber tapper, who the bandits came and demanded things. And this is a sort of lead you got. Sometimes it wouldn't lead anywhere. It was all very breathtaking, you know, because the jungle is jungle, you know. There could be a bandit behind every tree, you never know. But suddenly when somebody opens up, it's just like a bloody great house that's broken up right beside your ear. The noise is so tremendously loud. One incident we had, I was on a routine patrol, in as much as that we suspected bandits were getting through from these squatters. If I can just explain what a squatter is, the Chinese are so industrious, they leave the village, they go to a bit of jungle lying beside the main road, and they start hacking down the trees and creating their own little farm there. And this went on unrestricted after the war, and before the war, I suppose. And then gradually people were cotton on. They were getting a good living from this because they were industrious. They grow all this food, send it down the market, and begin to be prosperous on this. So more and more people began to do this, and they'd penetrate deeper and deeper into the jungle and where the terrain was suitable for it. And of course, gradually, as they got deeper into the jungle, the bandits loved it because it saved them coming out to get their food and to build up their information and sort of thing. So if we suspected bandits being in a certain area, this is one of my principles I worked on under those circumstances at that time. I'd go out to one of these Chinese squatter areas, and I'd go around all the houses, and through a Chinese, yes, we had one or two Chinese or a Chinese inspector somewhere, but in any case, if you didn't have, you could speak to them in Malay. You say, salam, salam alaikum, and they all know that means good morning, you know. Then you say, bandits, terrorists, you know, and they say, oh, they never know what you're talking about then. Even though the bandit had just left there, as it happened many, many a time, as we came into these squatter areas, the Chinese bandits were going out at the other end, you know. We were a little bit naive at the time. But we go into all these houses, and a couple of times, I remember, we went into lepers' houses that had leprosy, miles away from anywhere, you know, you could see. But in a way, sad circumstances, but they all lived like kings, really. They had their own land, a nice little bamboo hut to live in, you know, they had little pigs, they had dogs and things which they could eat, and they were growing the food. Life a Riley, really, but because they were under threat all the time from bandits.
How did you treat them when you were investigating these?
Oh, well, not like they did in Vietnam. I mean, this is nothing like the way the British worked. I mean, you had to make it quite clear to the Malays you were with, you know. They weren't to be bullied, these people, you know. Even though we knew they were working hand in glove with the Chinese, they liked to rough treat them. Never hit them, but I mean, they liked to be rough with them, the tone of voice, which isn't a way to cajole information from them, if you come to think of it, you know. But that was the way they reacted, natural antipathy to the Chinese, who in Malay's mind, they were keeping the bandits going, you know. But it wasn't my policy to do that. I usually had to have somebody with me, because they were used to talking to the Chinese who didn't speak Malay. You know, I could speak to a certain amount, and I'd do it in a gentler manner, you know. But no matter which way you did it, if you come to think about it and learn afterwards, there's no way could they give you information, because if they gave you information and they say, yeah, he was here half an hour ago and he went over there and that thing there, and you went over and then went up that track and found the bloke and killed him, then his mates come out that night and kill the Chinese bloke. It happened hundreds of times. There was no way could they give you information in a case like that. They couldn't do it. And you'd understand it. You could understand it because they were in the fear of their life and they were getting killed by the dozens if they didn't do what they were told. And on this, but let me tell you about this particular case. Apart from these Chinese bandits, Chinese communists, there were other gangs of bandits in the jungle, and they were the nationalist Chinese who'd some way or another, a long background, had also got mixed up in banditry in the jungle. Now, there was it appeared when the British government were fighting two lots of bandits, these communists who were good during the war against the Japanese, and these Kuomintang, these national Chinese, who we eventually got to surrender. In the middle of the Sungai Pira one night, they came over, handed all their weapons.
In the middle of what?
The River Pira, on an island there. This is where the surrender of this particular big bunch of nationalist Chinese, not the communist ones, decided to surrender. Now, these, we were very grateful to these people because it clarified the position. Everybody you met in the jungle now were communists. If you met any soldiers dressed in military, where they all were, they were no longer in our area any of the mainland Chinese nationalists. They were really communists, you know, the ones who fought for us against the Japanese through the war. That clarified at that point, because there's no way if you see anybody in the jungle, you say, well, who the hell are you? It doesn't happen like that. They either fire or you fire, and you've only got one chance, a fleeting fire, and they're gone, nothing else. So they surrendered, and I'd been given one of these Chinese blokes who used to live in this area where I was, which came under my particular territory. So I persuaded them to let me have this Chinese fella, one as a guide and one to try to get some information from these Chinese squatters in a nice way, you know what I mean? Rather than to rely on the blundering ways of the Malays with their natural antipathy towards these Chinese and my own ability with not being able to speak Cantonese at all. So on this particular period, they gave me one of these, I forget his name now, they gave me one of these people. And I found it absolutely wonderful because you come to a squatter area, you go right to the end of the squatter area, which might be 5 or 6 miles from the road, might take you 3 or 4 hours to get to the end when new squatters were coming. And they were the ones most vulnerable. They were the ones who would see the communists coming around at night time because they were the first into the jungle. So these are the people you're inclined to go for, you know, in the hope. So you go into a squatter house now with this Chinese bloke that I had, who himself had been a bandit. Although not a Chinese communist bandit, he was a Chinese nationalist bandit, which is different, different even being in the jungle. And he'd be able to question the Chinese there, and he'd come out and he'd say, oh, definitely they've been here, but he won't admit it, but they've definitely been here, I can tell from his way, you know, you can do this. The Malays wouldn't have known it, he was a bandit himself. And he brought me, in a way, my first success, because he showed me then, we went all the way around the squatter territory, it took all day to go around, you know, to go around and undulating ground in the secondary jungle, which had been cut down by the thing, and then once you cut the jungle down, you get the secondary growth coming, which becomes impenetrable, you know what I mean? It ruins the jungle when nomad people like the Aborigines or like these Chinese, it becomes secondary jungle. So it took a long time, but he taught me this, which is obvious, really. You go around the outside perimeter looking for tracks out of it. If the bandits are very clever, they never came in on the same route, they come in a different route. But when they do it over a long period, there are certain tracks become apparent. And he, this particular day, found a track, which it was too late to follow it up then, so we camped down for the night. And the next morning then, we picked up this track again and followed it. And this was my first big contact with a gang of bandits, really. We were going up and, as I've explained to you before, he was the tracker in this case. He would have a very idea when we were coming near the camp. So I didn't want him to stick his neck out, so I was going, he was saying this is the track, so I'd go ahead, you know, watching the sign, and you can see the track has been used lately, and you can always tell a new track, because as they go down it with their parang, they just knob off little bits of things, so if they get lost, they can find their way back again. So you get to know these things, you know. But this was quite a fairly well-defined track. Sometimes he'd be in front of me, very steep ground, you know, everything's mountainous out there, going up a hill like that, then going down, and it's, any wetness there, you're slipping and sliding, and trying to be quiet. It's very difficult to be really quiet like that, especially by the lads behind who are not in front. They just follow, you know, and make all sorts of noise, because you're conscious of it, because if anybody hears a noise, you're the dead bugger, you know. So anyway, we came on this track and we followed it for quite a long way, and we were, at this particular time, we were going up the hill, and he was saying to me, we were looking at each other, we both realised we must be near the camp. And of course, with experience, we got to learn one of the first things you had to do was to leave a track. You never follow a track. But if you have a track in the jungle, it gives you a direction to go, it gives you easy access and a direction, you know what I mean? But it's suicidal to stay on a track. But he, I think he thought he knew enough about the way to live in a jungle that he would know when it was time to leave the track. I suppose that's what he thought. I was thinking he thought that anyway. When, up ahead of us, I suppose about 30 or 40 yards away, there was a bloody great tree across the track. Lots of trees across the track. This one was a particularly bad one, and you look at trepidation with trees like this, is it an ambush? Is there anybody behind a tree, you know? But you've exposed yourself, they're looking down on you, they haven't fired or anything, you thought they would have fired, so you accept that there's nobody there. Wrong way to do it. Wrong way, you should leave the track completely, I found out afterwards. But anyway, we were going up this tall this tree, we're only 3 or 4 yards away from this tree when suddenly a brain gun opened up. And at that moment, he happened to be in front, and of course, he was the one who got shot. After a very short burst, the brain gun jammed. I wasn't actually conscious of it at the time, but the shooting suddenly stopped, and I dashed for cover behind a tree, and I looked around to see what was happening. I couldn't see a bloody soul in sight. Couldn't see a soul in sight. And I thought, hell, and he was lying on the track moaning. So then I had a rifle, and I made my way up to this tree, and the brain gun was lying there, but the bloke had gone. So this I learned afterwards, this was what their thing was. To fire a shot and go, he shouldn't have left his brain gun, but we were very near. Whether he'd not been aware of us, whether he hadn't been doing his job properly, if he had have been, he would have had the brain gun ready and all his kit done up, ready to fire a shot and run. But I think he was sort of caught half awake, otherwise he would never have left his gun there. But the gun was jammed, so we were lucky in that respect. So then, I was told under no circumstances must I let this bloke get into action and be killed, because he was a surrendered nationalist one. If those nationalist bandits, thought that we were going to take them out and use them like this, as fodder at the front of a patrol, they would no more would surrender. You know what I mean? It was an obvious reason why I had strict instructions to look after the fella and let nothing happen. That's why most of the time I was in front of him. If you've got to lead from the front, with a Malay, you've got to lead from the front. The Indians would come up. I found the Indians would be quite good. And some Malays. I had a Malay corporal who was very, very good. I seen him shoot a couple of bandits in situations where I don't think I could have succeeded myself. But in any case, this chap lay on the ground, and he wasn't dead, but he'd been quite badly wounded. So I got some of the Malays. They were good for this. And got them. I had to strike off a section, I think, of about 7 people to make up a stretcher and get this chap back to civilization as quickly as possible. So this is what they did. So this depleted the force I had by a third. I suppose I must have had 30 people, say. So 7 of them went. So that left me with about 20 people. And because my job now was to go on through the camp and try to follow them, which I did, but I lost my Chinese tracker, you know, so I had to then start using the Malays, who themselves are quite good at tracking, you know. Because later I was to work with the Aborigines, and that is the cream of everything. If you've got an Aborigine in the jungle, you'll never go wrong, but the Malays also are quite good, the best I'd seen up to this point, you know. So we went through this camp, and we kept on their trail, and that night we bivouacked down overnight, and the next morning we got up. A funny thing with the jungle, there's no twilight in Malaya. It's suddenly at 5 o'clock or whatever the time is, I forget it, pride. It suddenly goes from day to night, it suddenly becomes dark. So at certain times you've got to have your camp made and be in your hammock or wherever you're going to lay down for the night before it gets dark. It's much better to do that. You have no twilight. And of course, as soon as the daylight goes without the twilight and you go into darkness, suddenly all the millions and billions of insects suddenly stop all their noises, and suddenly from this deafening, what has been a deafening noise of insects, you suddenly get dead silence. And in the morning then, when it becomes daylight, suddenly, with no real dawn, when the dawn starts, there's come to a point when suddenly all these insects in the jungle, millions and millions of them, suddenly come to life again. And suddenly from the deafness of complete no noise, you suddenly get this tumultuous noise, what seemed to be of all these insects suddenly come to life. It's very noticeable out there, you know. So we would bivouac the next morning, overnight, and the next morning then we stirred quite early to get ourselves ready, because we were on the track of these bandits, you know. And they when after this boat was shot, we went through the camp. It's quite a large camp. It could have been up to 50 bandits we were talking about. And we were a band of 20 people, you know, so we had to be very careful because they could take us on any time and beat us, no doubt, you know, because they've been in the jungle for 6 years now. They've been all through the war with the Japanese, so they were quite skilled in that way. Even though in the camps, the instruction, fire one shot and they run for it, that's the only thing they could do because we could be a battalion of Gurkhas for all they knew, you know. So that's, they weren't running away. I mean, they were wise to do that. It was a very good system. Anyway, the next day, it was a bad day, a rain, and rain out there like monsoon, it goes in from morning, noon to night. And it's a great relief to have the rain, one, because it's very hot work climbing up and down these mountains with your ammunition and with your food or whatever you got for a few days. And when this rain starts, it cools you down, it's lovely. You don't see the daylight at all, the trees are 150, 200 feet high on these mountain ranges. And one thing I welcome the rain for, when it rains, you can imagine in a jungle or even in a thick park in this country, when it rains, the noise on the leaves of the rain beating down, you can imagine what monsoon rain beating down the top of jungle, it's so loud you can't hear yourself speak, which means you can blunder through the jungle and make as much noise as you like and nobody hears you. This is the one thing chasing a gang of bandits, you have to be, they can smell a cigarette, they can hear a tin rattle or a cup rattle, it travels for a long way. But in rain, you can't even hear yourself think, the noise is so tremendous. You're not following a path, you're following the direction of a track. You're keeping crisscrossing it or something like that. And at this particular time, we were within a couple of hundred yards of a big camp. All these people were in this camp astride this river. I heard the river, so I made towards it. And suddenly a wild pig came running towards us. And we knew then that a wild pig running towards humans like that, they must be running away from something. So then we knew we couldn't have been very far away from, because a wild pig, for my 10 years of Malaya, I never got an animal running towards me again in the same way. But this was definite, and I had a Chinese inspector with me by this on this particular patrol, and he explained as well. So when these two pigs became very alert, and I got everybody in the rain, I got word to it, I brought a couple of the corporals up, I made a plan. Oh, just before that, we made a little bit more progress and we suddenly come across the camp, the track leading into the camp. And I'd learned from the day before, I had to leave it, I couldn't stay on it. So I never even went on the track, I went across it. So I made my plan, and with this Chinese inspector, made sure these people understood what they had to do. And my plan was that I would go into the camp from this way and they would go up that way and over the river the other way and wait on the other side, up higher, so that when they fled, any of them flee, then they were to sit astride and take them on, you know, in a position where we wouldn't be shooting at them because it was down in the river, they were in this big torrential river that was coming through. Some of them were actually bathing in the river. But anyway, we made this plan and I got them all across this track and I waited till they'd all crossed it and sent them in the direction I had to go to. And I had with me a Bren gunner, one of these Malays who I'd taught to use Bren gunner, and he was a Bren gunner. And we were going up, and we'd gone across this track, and only a short way up this hill on the other side of the track, when, I can't explain to you, but we were on the steep mountain side of a steep hill, and it was pouring down with rain, and when I took this extra height up across this track, I looked down, and through the foliage, I saw the sentry on the track. I couldn't see his complete body, I saw his head and shoulders, other times I'd see his feet, not his head, he was there on guard on that track, he was the sentry, the near sentry. There could have been another one further along the track, but he was a near sentry guarding these people who you could almost spit down into the river now, but it's all down below you, you know what I mean? You couldn't see anything because of all the foliage of all the trees at the different heights between you. So I got this Bren gunner. I said, now what I want you to do is to watch him. As soon as any shooting starts, you open up on him, make sure you get him. But don't shoot him before the shooting starts. Wait for